You are listening to Pastor Talk.
One of the terms you'll hear is neuroplasticity, and all that really means is that your mind is just like your body and that it adapts to whatever you have it do over time. You can't be a marathon runner and a leg lifter, and you can't be a champion tweeter and read Dostoevsky all the time.
Welcome to Pastor Talk, the podcast of Lifeway Pastors, giving you the tools and encouragement you need to shepherd your flock well. I'm your host, Marty Duren. My guest today on Pastor Talk is John C. Dyer. John Dyer is the Executive Director of Communications and Educational Technology and Adjunct Professor in Media Arts and Worship at Dallas Theological Seminary. John likes to say, "When I code, I can feel God's pleasure." This desire to glorify God by showing how our creativity is an important aspect of our work in America drives his work and teaching. John's a former youth pastor. He now enjoys working with students to see how the biblical story brings insight and clarity to the ideas found in science, sociology, and culture. John's married to Amber, who is a literature professor and philosophy professor, and has two lovely children. John is the author of From the Garden to the City, The Redeeming and Corrupting Power of Technology, which will form the basis of our talk today. Thanks again for joining me on Pastor Talk. My guest today is John Dyer, Dallas Theological Seminary. And just saying that makes me feel like I don't really want to ask a lot of questions. John, welcome to Pastor Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. You're probably not as familiar a name to most of our listeners as other Johns like Piper and MacArthur and Calvin and people like that. But you wrote what I think is a fairly significant book. We're going to talk a little bit about the themes in that today. But tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of at a personal level.
Yeah, that's great. So I am currently a professor and a communications and educational technology director down at Dallas Theological Seminary. So I teach in theology and also media and technology issues, and I oversee all of our, you know, internet and all those kinds of things there. And so I've spent a lot of time working as a web developer and a coder. That's really what I love doing. I just really enjoy making stuff. And so I get to build things here at the school and also build things for other companies and continue to do that, even though I'm still sort of half professor, half hacker, if you will.
So, but the real question is, do you run the sound booth at church? I mean, that's all anybody cares about, right?
Right. No, you know, my area of technology is mostly the internet, digital stuff. I don't know what all the dials do. I know I've been told that they're all significant, but I don't know what they do.
Well, I don't know what church you go to, but if you ever go to one that runs less than 250 in Sunday school or small groups, then you're probably going to be behind the soundboard at some point.
Yeah, people do tend to look over and say, can you help me with something? And I've often been that guy.
That's awesome. So the title of the book that caught my attention is From the Garden to the City, and it's about technology. The subtitle is The Redeeming and Corrupting Power of Technology. Mm-hmm. So when I first saw that, I thought of the name Jacques Ellul. I don't know if I'm saying that right, the famous French philosopher who did a lot with in the area of technology. I'm not an expert, but just knowing that people have been exploring this for longer than when your book was published is of interest to me.
Oh, yeah.
So why don't start kind of give us a big picture of what's happening with technology and spirituality?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's really important that we all do is we think about, you know, how technology can be used for good things or bad things. So we're really concerned with the evils that we see out in the world and avoiding those as believers and wanting to stress holiness. But I think a lot of these thinkers, like you mentioned, Ellul and Marshall McLuhan and Postman and all of those guys, they're trying to think about bigger things than just morality. Again, that's really, really important. And sometimes they get kind of negative. So I think Ellul is almost the point where he thinks that technology is something that God didn't originally want.
Right.
And so it's helpful he...
Hey, dude, there were no outlets in the Garden of Eden, you know.
Yeah, right. So as great as I think some of those authors are, the idea of this From the Garden to the City is that the whole story of Scripture seems to show just how important human creativity, including technology, is, so much so that the plan is not to go back to a garden where we frolic around naked, but to move forward to this new heavens and new earth that has a heavenly city full of things that people have made, roads and trumpets and banners and maybe even iPads.
Hey, I would be down with that. You know, I don't know if we're going to need iPads on the new earth, but if we do, right, then I'd be okay with that. Just by way of reference, you referenced Marshall McLuhan and Neil Postman as well, thinkers in this area. So people say sometimes that technology is a tool. So it's basically just, you know, a digital wrench or, you know, a hose pipe or something like that. It's neutral. It's amoral. But you don't know that that's a helpful way to look at technology. Why do you kind of think that's not the best way to look at it?
Ah, that's a great question. Yeah. So on one side, people often talk about technology in a way that we call determinism. So they're basically saying things like technology makes us stupid or it makes us narcissistic. And they're kind of giving it a lot of agency. On the other side of it is maybe instrumentalism or the belief that technology is neutral. Now, I would probably agree that maybe it's morally neutral in the sense that the phone in your pocket isn't either good or bad.
Right, right.
But when people say neutral, I think that's problematic. And here's why. Because I think whenever we use any technology, whether we're using it for good or for bad, it still has a capacity to shape us. And so one of the simplest explanations or examples of this is using a shovel. Whether you're digging a hole to build a church and that's really good, or you're digging it to axe murder and bury somebody, either way you get blisters, right? And
those so you
blisters
think, there's, you think there's a moral difference between those two things?
I think there's a moral difference, yes, between building a church and axe murdering.
Okay,
right?
I'm just checking. But you know, even, I don't know you that well. I'm just checking.
Yeah, yeah. But even if they're even that moral difference doesn't really affect how the technology shapes us, right? Mm-hmm. So the same thing with the phone. Whether all we're doing is reading great sermons and podcasts and Bible stuff, or we're using it for evil things, it still is shaping us either way. And that's why I don't think it's useful to call it neutral.
Okay, that's a good point. But so if you were going to give a definition of technology, I mean, almost everybody listening to this will be using technology to some degree. Mm-hmm. I read an article in The Guardian this morning written by, I'm going to mess this guy's name up, I'm sure. I think his name is Mike Broyle. It may be Boyle with a Y. He's one of these guys that's gone completely off the grid, doesn't use modern medicine, grows all of his own herbs, you know, and eats cottontail or whatever when he gets an upset stomach. But he's a regular columnist for The Guardian, and he handwrites his column and mails it to The Guardian newspaper, and then they type it up and publish it. Then they type up or copy comments, and then they print them and mail them back to him. He refuses. He has no cell phone, no cell service, no electricity, none of that kind of stuff. So we think about a person like that as completely devoid of technology. But we don't always think about technology as a thing as we're using it. So to help us, what's a good definition of technology that'll help us think biblically about it as we move forward?
Okay, well, I'm going to give you two. One of them is kind of just a funny one, and the other one might be a little bit more robust. So one of them comes from Alan Kay, who invented the mouse, and his definition is, technology is anything invented after you were born. So what he means by that is that everything before we were born, we don't think of as technology. It's just the way the world works,
right,
and that's why you and I don't really question cars or airplanes or light bulbs, but our kids don't question touchscreens, right, because that's just what's normal to them. And in fact, they think my computer is broken since they can't touch it.
That's right.
So that just helps us all think about our perspective based on our age and all that kind of stuff. But for me, the way I often think about technology is kind of two things. One is it's God-given, and two is it's a transformative force. So I would say technology is a God-given transformative force. What that does is helps me say that the scriptures seem to say that human creativity is good, full stop. So it's God-given. At the same time, it's always going to be transforming something. It's going to transform my culture, my family, myself, my body, my mind, something like that. And so that helps me think through what I'm going to do with it.
So clearly, technology in the Bible, even if you go to the stuff that was, you know, invented after David was born, if you're going to talk about, you know, brass and bronze and spears and arrows and wheels and things of that nature, the Bible doesn't say anything about the kind of technology that we deal with. So the ability to, I can't not think about the capacity in my phone. It's so overwhelming to think about all the things that I can do. And I'm not just talking about reading information. I'm talking about actual things that I can accomplish as a human being on my phone. It's so remarkable. I think someone has said it is the most important invention. I don't know if they said ever or in the last, you know, 1,000 years or whatever, but I could certainly see that point. But the Bible doesn't say thou shalt not iPhone. You know, it doesn't say thou shalt not have more than 2 megabytes or, you know, gigabytes of data a month in your plan or anything like that. So what does the Bible have to say that we can apply to technology?
No, wait, could you repeat that? I was watching some cat videos on my phone.
Dude, I don't know. I've already moved on. I'm watching memes now.
That's right. That's right. No, well, I think on one hand, the Bible is going to really say that human creativity is important. So if we look at the stories of, you know, pre-electronic technology of God, you know, in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, after they sin, they immediately make something and God shows them how to make something better, right? Mm-hmm. So I think he's saying this is good stuff. Even with the ark and Noah, he's saying, I'm gonna use human creativity to literally save humanity. And then Jesus is called a tekton, right? That's the Greek word from which we get technology. And we translate that as carpenter because he's working with things and he's making them. And even the story of our own faith, we can't tell without referencing something that humans made, the cross, right? Mm-hmm. So it's there all the way through. God is saying, this is important to me and I care about it. But even in the Ten Commandments, though, the second commandment talks about our use of imagery to portray God. And I think he's saying, you know, at the level of adultery and murder and obeying your parents is how we use images and technology and worship and in our understanding of God. And so I think it's very, very important there. And there's all kinds of, you know, the kind of basic ethics about walking humbly and doing justice and loving mercy that are important for us. So I think God is valuing it, but I think to get deeper, we're probably going to have to start looking at some of, you know, the Pauline language about spirit and flesh to really go deeper into modern technology.
When I was in high school, we used, you know, Bunsen burners and flasks, and people who were more responsible than us probably got to play with chemicals and stuff like that. You know, I had a car, we had a wall phone with a cord. You know, I remember getting a stereo system for Christmas one year. You know, my dad bought TVs fairly regularly as they increased in size and scope. And that was technology for us. And most people recognized, you know, the good and the bad of of television. Most people recognized the good and the bad of, you know, radio, whatever. Do you think that modern electronic, and I'll just say slash kind of digital technology that is now almost the air we breathe in a real sense. Does it differ from these old technologies and tools, the things that were kind of, you know, I didn't pick up my stereo system and carry it with me in the car. I had a separate one, and then there was a Walkman. Is it different now? Is it different to have an iPad than it was to have a typewriter?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's some significant differences. I mean, on one hand, you know, we do want to point back and say that all human creativity kind of fits in this class, right? And that this is something that God values and is important. But then I think it's useful for us to start thinking about why is a shovel so different than an iPad? And why are some of these modern things so different? So here's some of the things that I think are important. One of them is Marshall McLuhan, the guy that we talked about earlier. One of the ways he would define technology is that it's always an extension of your humanity. So if you think about a telescope extending your eyes or glasses extending your eyes or a car extending your legs and so forth or a shovel extending your arms. If we think about what does modern technology extend, probably one of the biggest differences is that something like an iPhone is really primarily working on operating it at the level of your mind, right? And it's something that's not physical, that you can't see it. So I think sometimes its effects are harder to detect because unlike blisters that we see immediately, some of the things that are happening in our mind are slower and take place over time. Mm-hmm. I think another big difference for us is that a lot of modern technology actually does something for us rather than helping us do something. So, you know, if you think about the difference between like a shovel being easier to dig with than like, say, a Roomba that you just press a button and it runs around and actually does the work for you, you know, that's a big difference.
To push that button, though. Come on now. Or to program it.
And I'm personally looking forward to a self-driving car where I can just sit back and read or hang out with the family. So I'm looking forward to having technology do something for me. At the same time, when it comes to the mental stuff, that's where it can become important, right? Because, you know, if you think about what does the Bible ask you to do with the Bible, most of us would say, well, we'll read the Bible. But really, what the Bible asks you to do most often is to meditate, right? And then to do what it asks you to do. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever had to use GPS more than once to get to the same place.
Yes.
You know, you use it once,
yep.
And then you have to use it again. Well, eventually we start to get what McLuhan would say is it's not just an extension of you, but it becomes an amputation of you eventually. So you become dependent on it. And so if you become dependent on it doing things for you, you want to ask what things is it doing for me? And if one of those things is, you know, say looking up scripture instead of memorizing it, that might not be something that's helpful to
you. That's a great point. That alone is worth this entire podcast. Honestly, I've never heard anyone or even thought about how the ease now to which we have access to reference has eliminated the need. Well, it hasn't eliminated the need, but it's eliminated our propensity to memorize. That's a great point.
Yeah. And I think people complained about that with printed Bibles too, you know, where before those, the only thing we had was what we would hear. Mm-hmm. And so if we heard it on a Sunday, we kind of had to remember it. There was no other option if we didn't have a printed Bible. And then, you know, memorization goes down with print, and then it goes down especially with digital Bibles. And I build Bible software, and I believe this is a good thing in general, but I also believe that there's some unintentional transformations that come with the digital Bible as well.
So to divert just a second, so we're talking about technology. We're talking about obviously the implications for spirituality, which means there's implications for church life. You build Bible apps, which, you know, lead people to Facebook during the sermon. You need to go ahead and own up to that. You're causing the distraction yourself. But seriously, there has been some amount of technology, if we want to say by the extending of ourselves, even with, you know, microphones and amplification, organs that are electric or, you know, air powered or whatever. I don't even know how all that stuff works, but it is technological or electronic. You know, you have choir mics, you have solo mics, you have praise team mics, you have all these things. You have live stream services, you have screens, you know, in the auditorium. You have the ability to bring images and words onto screens that may not be part of the printed materials. Is this stuff affecting us negatively? Do we need to think through how we utilize all of these tools? I mean, microphones in church aren't even, they're not given a first thought unless they don't work, much less a second thought. I mean, they're just, it's ubiquitous to our experience of going to a gathering is to have some of these tools that have been around forever. Is it possible that we're distracting, or is it just something we have to make sure doesn't distract? I'm not sure yet.
Yeah. So I think the subject of distraction is really worth thinking about on its own. But when it comes to just the church question, I'll just pick up two of them that you mentioned. One of those is sort of the projector and screens in churches. And back when I was a youth pastor, I asked to get one because I knew that, you know, half the kids brought Bibles, half of them didn't, and I thought it would be easier to just show it up on the screen. Well, what I found was that when I showed it on screen, of course, nobody brought their Bibles to church anymore, right? So it had this unintentional effect. But at the same time, I think there was some good in it, and that we're all reading the same thing at the same time, as opposed to everybody having their own personal, you know, different copies, and somebody's got the Women's Study Bible and somebody's got the Cat Lovers Bible and all that stuff. It was a much more communal experience. So I think this is the point, is that we want to be able to detect these kind of unintentional things that happen. When we put the Bible up on screen, it changes the way we interact with the Bible, and we want to think through that. The other one you mentioned was the microphone, and I think with the microphone in the car, when you put those two technologies together, you get this new thing called a megachurch, right? Something that didn't exist in previous generations. So you start seeing megachurches in the 50s when we start amplifying who we can speak to. Now, a megachurch, you go, well, what's the difference? What's the big deal with that? Well, when you've got a giant church, more than, say, a couple hundred people, now you can't know everybody in church anymore. So what do? You create a small group ministry. And what kind of small groups do we have? Well, we do them based on affinities. So we have, you know, 36-year-old men who play golf. That becomes a small group.
And
Paul says older men should teach younger men and older women should teach younger women. And yet that's not how we organize small groups usually in the megachurch. So we want to think through this new technology makes something new possible. Like a big church can have some incredible ministries that a small church can't have. But we also want to be thinking about the directions that it pushes us, and thinking about you know, individualism and individual preference versus thinking about what might be a little bit more biblical way of doing community, for example.
That's really interesting. So we mentioned distraction, and then we got distracted and moved on to something else. And by the way, I followed you back on Twitter while you were talking, just so you'll know.
Good. Okay.
So I have noticed, and I think even Philip Yancey said on maybe on Twitter. This is so bizarre to even say this. He talks about being distracted and losing his train of thought on Twitter. But he, you know, he's an author. He's written books of 200 and 300 pages and has doubtless read books of, you know, thousands of pages or whatever. But he recently, maybe within the last 6 weeks, made a public statement that he thought maybe social media was affecting his attention span. And I've noticed, my job is in social, I mean, my job was in social media. Now my job includes social media. And so I've been, you know, in Facebook almost ever since they opened it up to parents. And so Twitter and all that. So I have noticed, my attention span isn't, where I can sit down and read half a book at a time anymore, or if I can, it's a struggle to stay in the chair without reaching for my phone to see if somebody's texted me or tagged me or something like that. Is there a physiology? Is there a psychology behind this distraction?
Yeah, that is a great question. I mean, this is the big thing that a lot of people are trying to study. And one of the terms you'll hear is neuroplasticity. And all that really means is that your mind is just like your body and that it adapts to whatever you have it do over time. So, for example, if when we go into a gym, we choose tools based on how we want them to shape our body, right? So if we do a treadmill, we want long, lean legs. And if we do like a leg press, we want big, strong legs. And the catch is that we can't do both. So if you want to have your mind be shaped in a direction where you're really good at reading long books, you need to do that. And if you want to be able to read lots of little disconnected bits, then you should do that a lot. It's just hard to do both, right? Your mind you can't be a marathon runner and a leg lifter, and you can't be a champion tweeter and read Dostoevsky all the time, right?
Tweetable Dostoevsky.
Yeah. You just can't. Those are just two different activities. And so you need to decide which kind of mind you want to shape. Just like, you know, when you're shaping your body, if you choose an apple versus a candy bar, you know it's going to change you. But I think the other thing is that our modern technology is really good at privileging our impulses over our intentions. So this comes from James Williams. But the idea is that sometimes we want to do something that's our intention. We have this desire to read a long book or to do something on our phone that's legitimate, like look up something. But then it has so many different ways of getting at little impulses in you that you see those little red circles with a number in it. Just can't help but go to those things. So it takes a lot of willpower and a lot of planning, I think, and a lot of getting angry at technology creators for saying, how can I restructure in a way that is most helpful to me?
Oh, man, I feel like I need to go to the altar. So how then, I know two people. I preached a sermon recently in our church. I'm not the lead pastor, but I preach periodically. And I talked about how what we choose to consume information-wise eventually becomes our filter. So if we choose to consume scripture, then everything else is filtered through scripture. But if we choose to immerse ourselves in a news, you know, source, and we trust that news source, then eventually it becomes our filter, to the point that even scripture becomes filtered through what we believe to be true rather than the other way around. So how do we get out of that trap? How do we begin to reprogram, get our minds shaped in a different way? Is it possible to coexist with technology in a spiritually productive way?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that there is a strategy of just completely disconnect and try to, you know, live off the grid and all those kinds of things. And I'm not sure that that's really a helpful way of being in the world, but not of the world. I mean, it's a choice. But even the author that you mentioned at the beginning, he's basically just pushing all of it on somebody else. He's making somebody else do the technology work for him. So I think living actively in this world is probably a better strategy. But doing that's really, really hard. So I think one thing I would say first off is just to take stock and look at, honestly, one great way to do that if you're an iPhone user is to download this little application called Moment, and it just tracks how many minutes a day you spend on your phone. And it can be really enlightening just to think about, do I really need to spend that much time, or maybe would I do better if I rearranged my life a little bit? So just taking stock. And then the other great way is to ask someone significant around you, you know, do they primarily see the back of your phone or do they see your eyeball? So just asking those people around you, and then asking yourself, what kind of habits do I want to be doing? What is it that if I sat down and I said, what is my phone for? And you write down kind of, what am I actually going to use this thing for? Because most of the time we have a million apps on there. You know, we have two or three Bible apps and we have 100 ones that can distract us and consume us. So thinking through those, what do I want to do with it? And then rearranging.
You mentioned, you know, talking to the people around you to see if all they ever see is the back of your phone. There's a very, very subversive way to get around that. And that is just to make sure they have a phone too, because they're going to fall prey to the same exact trap. And then you're all sitting around looking at your phone.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not quite the hard case on that as some people are. Maybe I should be more of it, but, I know that, let me say it this way, not that phones do this. I know that it can be the situation where, you know, if everybody's at dinner and they're just kind of, you know, reading stuff on their phone, it can actually cause conversation rather than simply taking the place of conversation. So I think part of what we struggle with, though, is when we're on our individual device, it does tend to lead us toward isolation, even when we're around others. So I think if we can remember that some of the content that we're consuming is of interest to other people, we can use it to start conversations rather than to avoid conversations. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. And I think one thing to think about just before we get right into, say, the phone and the dinner is to remember that out there, there are technology companies that are employing like people with 17 PhDs in human attention and all kinds of computer degrees. And their entire job is to get your eyes on your phone as often as possible in order to sell you ads, right? So you were trying to say, I bet I can beat 1,000 Googlers. Right? I can overcome that with my own will. That's really hard to do. I think just acknowledging that is really, really important for us because people are vying for your attention in a very active way worth billions of dollars. So when we say like, I can probably just beat them, you know, that's a bold claim, you know? So recognizing that it's pull on your own heart and then recognizing that our own posture, you know, when Paul talks about the spirit and the flesh, I think by spirit, he's basically meaning your direction toward God and toward your neighbor. And by flesh, he's meaning your kind of tendency to direct back toward yourself, kind of the incurvature of the soul toward the self. And our phones and our devices, they're really, really good at encouraging that kind of self-enclosure of kind of becoming like a turtle and pulling yourself in because you're getting all these little short-term pieces of feedback. So I think it takes a lot of effort to do what you're saying, to say, I'm going to be outwardly directed and look at my child or my spouse or my roommate or whoever it is and talk to them. So I do think that's probably why it's good to have some intentional time. Maybe you say, I've heard Andy Crouch say, you know, an hour a day a week a year, where you just say, we're all going to do this, and we're going to do it not just as individuals, but together as a community, right? We're going to do this as a practice of not just individuals, but of whatever your community is.
So last question. We've talked a lot about theory and even about church. Parenting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are some things that parents can think about? I mean, you've already mentioned, and we've seen the videos of babies who are trying to swipe on magazine pages to get the image to change because they've been, you know, they're already being raised with iPads and phones and swiping and tapping and stuff is normal to them. Where are some boundaries? What are some ways parents can think about? I mean, I think we pretty much have an idea that teenagers need extra watching, but I mean, it starts a lot younger than the teenage years. So talk to parents for just a second about, or pastors about how to talk to parents about technology with their kids.
Yeah, well, first, I'd recommend Andy Crouch's new book, Techwise Parenting. It's probably one of the better books on just parenting in general. It has lots of great resources. And there's all kinds of resources out there like Common Sense Media for sort of thinking through just the morality of different pieces of content. But I think big picture, what we're trying to do with our kids is we want to launch them to be successful. So if we just tighten everything down and never let them use anything and then kick them out when they're 18 without any skills, that's not going to be very good.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if we just hand them devices when in there too and expect them to understand it, that's not going to be good. So somewhere along the work, along the way, we've got to do the work of parenting. The American Pediatric Association would say no screens before 18 months or 24 months. So they're saying it doesn't matter if it's Baby Wise or Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. Either one is bad for them, but when they're before they're two. So that would be the first just easy one to do, is if you can avoid any TV show before two. And then I think as kids are growing up, one of the things you often hear parents talk about is screen time. Mm-hmm. And again, this is one that I would say I don't think is useful. What I try to do with my kids is differentiate between if they're creating something and if they're consuming something. Uh-huh. So if one of my kids says, hey, I want to write a story on the computer, or I want to edit a video, or I want to paint, I'll let them do that for as many hours as they want to do that. If they say, I want to watch a show, then we'll think a little bit more about that time usage. So I think one thing is just to encourage people to say, these devices are for making things. Mm-hmm. They're not just for consuming things. That's one big one. And then trying to think through, how do we use them in a way that's kind of communal rather than individual? So what I probably say is that, you know, in general, most kids don't need devices usually until at the very earliest middle school. And then at that point, you know, when it came to the previous big technology that meant you were an adult, which was a car, right? Nobody cares about cars anymore. But with a car, we kids don't want cars, right? They want phones. But remember, when we gave them cars, we waited till they were 15 and we made them go through this huge amount of training and responsibility, and there are consequences to it if you violated it. So I think we just want to do the same thing with a phone. We want to think through how to do some intense training with them, how to do some follow-up, and how to set some boundaries. So if you search for like family technology contract, there's a million of those on Google. Those can be a really useful framing device. And then I think just checking up every 6 months. And what we've given our kids is one more little rule is just to say the expectation is that they are going to see something evil on the internet. So it's not that we're going to be able to prevent it. We just believe they will see it. And so the idea with our kids is that we just tell them, hey, if you see something that you know you shouldn't see, close the laptop or the phone and come talk to us about it, and you won't be in trouble, and then we'll work through what's going on. So they have that expectation in there, and then we work through it with them.
My guest today on Pastor Talk has been John Dyer, the author of From the Garden to the City, The Redeeming and Corrupting Power of Technology, but not the sound guy at his church. So, John, I am, man, this has been really, really good. It's been good for me, not to mention enormously interesting. And I know that it'll be an encouragement to everybody who hears it. I really appreciate your time today.
Good. I'll see you on Twitter, okay?
All right.
Pastor Talk is the podcast of Lifeway Pastors and is hosted by Marty Duran. That's me. Join us each week as I interview pastors, authors, professors, and others to help your ministry as you seek to shepherd your flock well. Until next time, this is Marty Duran.